Welcome back to Books with Bert. This is Bert Folsom, and our book this week is a book I wrote with my wife Anita entitled Uncle Sam Can't Count. In fact, it's the first chapter of the book because it's the first business subsidy in U.S. history. You may be thinking, what is the first business subsidy in U.S. history? It came very early. It was the subsidy to the fur trade. Beaver pelts were the first target of this government subsidy. Buying and selling furs was a major industry in early American society, and the beaver was the key animal in the fur trade. Beaver pelts were in demand for hats. The hats were in style all over Europe in the 1700s. Trading furs was a worldwide enterprise, linking fashionable men and women in Paris to New York exporters who bought pelts from frontier traders who bargained with the Indian trappers. The pelts of beavers, muskrats, otters, and mink went overseas to become hats, coats, and rugs. Kettles, blankets, axes, and muskets went into the United States from these countries to pay Indians for their trapping skills. Fur trading was not a new industry at all in the United States. The British and French traded with Indians for centuries, and the Americans simply picked up where they left off. Trapping methods, river routes, trading posts were already in place when America became a nation. The man who disrupted the private enterprise in furs was none other than President George Washington himself. Washington was concerned with British encroachment on American territory. He analyzed the British fur trade in the Michigan-Wisconsin area because the British had been coming into this area called the Northwest Territory, and the British company called the Hudson Bay Company had been trading with Indians in the area, and Washington was concerned that British interference was a menace to the United States' future. British agents might stir up the Indians, win their loyalties, and thwart U.S. expansion. Private American traders, Washington believed, were too few in number to compete with the larger, more experienced British company. Therefore, Washington believed the U.S. government itself was needed to build large trading posts, oust the British, and in the words of Washington, quote, bring in a small profit and fix the Indians strongly in our interest, end quote. These Indians, or Native Americans, especially needed to see evidence of American strength, Washington argued. So he recommended that the government build and operate a series of fur factories, as he called them, throughout the Northwest Territory, that is, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin. With Washington's support, Congress appropriated $50,000 for the new factories in 1795 and raised it steadily in later years to $300,000. Now, such a subsidy was large for the day. The United States was a new nation, and we were already in debt, and this subsidy of $300,000 tested the government's ability to succeed in business. Here is how the factory system worked. The government created a bureaucracy to conduct the fur trade, the Office of Indian Affairs, it was called. This Office of Indian Affairs used the $300,000 from Congress to set up trading posts, usually in or near military forts, stock these trading posts with goods, and pay American agents to buy, store, and transfer furs from the trading post to Washington, D.C., where they would be sold at auction. Once these factories were funded, they were supposed to be self-supporting. Washington believed they might bring in a small profit. Those were his words. Agents in the factories would use the first batch of goods to buy furs, and then when the furs were sold, the agents could buy more goods and repeat the cycle. Thus, the U.S. would be making a profit, in addition to selling some furs and keeping the Indians within the United States, working on behalf of the United States, and not part of the British who were operating in Canada further north. Indeed, almost from the start, the first factory system struggled. This was the problem. Well into the 1800s, British companies were trading actively throughout the Great Lakes area. Now, so were private American traders. The factories were so poorly run that many Indians held them in contempt and refused to trade with these American fur factories. Why? Why were they such a disaster? If we look at the chief operator, a man named Thomas McKinney, who operated the factories in the early 1800s, we can see the problems. First, Thomas McKinney, the fur trade operator, tried to put his stamp on the fur business in many ways. He refused to give credit to the Indians for trapping. The Indians often needed supplies, and when they couldn't get credit, they couldn't become fur trappers. But McKinney thought it was risky to give untested Indians supplies, and they might run off, and therefore we won't operate on credit. So those Indians did not get startup costs by Mr. McKinney. The second point is McKinney felt obligated, and was obligated, to buy American for the factories when possible. Now, the Indians needed muskets, so McKinney rejected the cheaper, high-quality British muskets and gave the contracts to Americans who produced a musket, but it was at a greater cost and was not as good a musket as the British were producing. So the goods in the American factories were not as good as could be had outside the American factories. Third, McKinney wanted the Indians to abandon their nomadic ways, abandon fur trapping. He wanted them to become farmers. Therefore, he stocked the American fur factories with hoes, plows, and other farm equipment. This was part of his campaign, in McKinney's words, to amend the heads and hearts of the Indian. He urged agents at the factories to have gardens outside their walls to show the Indians they could grow. All they had to do was exchange their pelts for plows. Then their heads and hearts would be amended, and McKinney would have his wish. But McKinney's ideas were a disaster. Indians needed credit, and they hated farming. But since McKinney was funded regularly each year by the government, regardless of his volume of trade, he had no incentive to change his tactics. Private traders, however, had to please Indians or go broke. Therefore, private traders grew in numbers and dealt successfully with the Indians. An immigrant named John Jacob Astor became the chief private operator of the fur trade in the United States. He became the best of the best. Astor was an immigrant from Germany. His father was a butcher. Astor came from a modest background. He came to the United States at the age of 20 to join his brother in selling violins and flutes. Soon, however, he changed his tune. He became fascinated with the fur trade and studied it day and night. He learned prices, markets, and trade routes for all kinds of pelts. The fur territory of New York and Montreal was where he started. Later, when that area became barren of furs, he moved his fur trade out west toward Michigan. The Great Lakes area, especially Michigan and Wisconsin, became the heart of the fur trade, and they pumped out thousands of skins for coats and rugs all over the world. Astor founded the American Fur Company in 1808 and made his move to challenge the government factories. Now, Astor differed from McKinney and the government factories in many ways. McKinney and his predecessors just built trading posts, stocked them with goods, and expected the Indians to come there to trade. Many Indians, however, lived hundreds of miles away from a government factory, and they had no supplies for trapping. Even if McKinney had given credit easily and had known whom to trust, the Indians would have been hampered by the distances. Under Astor's system, the fur traders lived with the Indians, learned who to trust, and bought and sold on the spot. In other words, Astor had his agents live with Indian tribes and trade directly with them so that buying and selling could be done instantly. Astor built on this advantage by trading the best supplies he could find at reasonable prices. Indians wanted guns and blankets, and Astor supplied them at low cost. The best blankets he could find were British-made, blue-striped blankets. Astor bought them at 15% less than McKinney paid for his lower-quality blankets made in America. Astor also brought British-made muskets called Tower muskets, the best on the market, for about $10 a piece. McKinney paid $12.50 each for American-made muskets. So Astor had an advantage. He was selling better products at lower prices. And also, Astor accepted the Indians as they were, not as he wanted them to be. If they desired axes, kettles, and muskets, he tried to find the best available and sell them to the Indians at competitive prices. He respected the Indians as shrewd traders and knew he had to have the best goods to get the most business from these Indians. Astor paid his chief managers, the people who worked for him, good salaries plus a share of the profits. It was a merit system. People who worked for Astor had an incentive to trade and trade abundantly. This guaranteed attention to detail, which Astor needed to stay on top. McKinney and his staff, by contrast, received a standard salary from Congress with no bonuses given in profitable years. If McKinney had been on a merit system, he might have been less inclined to stock his factories with hoes and plows. Also, he stocked his factory from time to time with jews' harps, that is, a musical instrument, and even Chinese mandarin dresses. One final area of Astor's genius was his marketing savvy. He sold his furs at auctions all over the world. If he didn't get the prices he wanted in New York, he sent his furs to auctions in Montreal or even overseas to London, St. Petersburg. Astor studied the bidding, searched for trends, and moved quickly when prices changed. McKinney, in his operation of the government factories, lacked sophistication. He had the furs collected in his factories and sent to Washington. Then he sold them at auction in nearby Georgetown for whatever price they would bring. McKinney was steadily losing business to Astor. The private companies, with their own money, were outperforming the government factory with federal funds. McKinney tried to offset the advantage Astor had created by, certain tactics that were very questionable. For example, he went to Congress to try to ban the private fur trade. He felt if you could ban Astor, then he could have the whole business for himself. That didn't work. McKinney also tried to stir up the Indians to revolt against Astor. Well, they liked him, so that didn't work. McKinney also went to Congress to try to get license fees established for all fur trade operators. Since McKinney didn't really have very many fur trade operators, he would not be hurt by this very much. Astor had hundreds of people in the business with him, and if they had steep license fees for each one of these people, it would hurt Astor and make McKinney more competitive. In other words, McKinney was trying to use government to increase his competitive position. Astor was appalled at McKinney's efforts to use government, not only to receive a subsidy, but to try to squelch private fur trading. Astor was the top fur trader in the country, a man popular with the Indians. He gave them what he wanted, where they wanted it, and when they wanted it. McKinney, by contrast, was failing because he expected Indians to march hundreds of miles to the government factories to trade for plows they didn't want or for muskets, which they did want, but not at McKinney's high prices. Astor hated to play politics, but he believed he had to be political in order to survive. Astor urged governors in Illinois and Michigan to tell the government that Astor was doing a better job than the government. Governor Ninian Edwards of the Illinois Territory, for example, agreed with Astor and told the Secretary of War, quote, "For my part, I have never been able to discover, and I defy any man to specify, a solitary public advantage that has resulted from the government fur system in this country." Governor Lewis Cass of the Michigan Territory said essentially the same thing. "The government," Cass said, "should never come into contact with the Indians, but in cases where its dignity, strength, and liberality will inspire the Indians with either respect or fear." From 1816 to 1822, Congress heard from both sides on the fur trade issue. The debate over should the fur trade be subsidized by the government reached a head when the government decided to do a survey and find out whether the Indians and others thought that the government fur trade had value. Astor approved this. The government report decisively showed that the fur trade was not doing a good job. The head of this survey, Jedediah Morse, concluded, "I have to observe that the factory system does not appear to me to be productive of any great advantage, either to the Indians themselves or to the government." Politicians who saw this failed subsidy came to Astor's support. One of them was Senator Thomas Hart Benton, who had formerly worked with Astor and now is a U.S. Senator from Missouri. On the Senate floor, Benton ridiculed McKinney's purchases, particularly the 1,152 jute harps McKinney had recently sent to the factories. "What use," Benton asked, "could Indians have for jute harps?" "I know," Benton said sarcastically. "They are part of McKinney's schemes to amend the heads and hearts of the Indians, to improve their moral and intellectual faculties, and to draw them from the savage and hunter race and induct them into the innocent pursuits of civilized life." Benton therefore urged Congress to abolish the factory system. He said, quote, "Every public consideration requires it to be immediately abolished, and the accounts of which should be settled up and closed. The capital should be returned to the public treasury, the salaries of all officers should be stopped, and the profit and loss should be known at the next session of Congress." Most congressmen agreed. The Senate voted 17 to 11 to end the factory system. The House of Representatives soon followed. On May 6th, 1822, President Monroe signed Benton's bill, "The Government Factories would be abolished." All the goods and supplies in the factory system were sold, and the $300,000 that originally bought those supplies netted a return of only $56,038.15. As Senator Benton said, "The factory system grew out of a national calamity and has been one itself." The good news here is that a bad subsidy was stopped. It was eliminated. We discovered what went wrong, and we stopped it. What can we learn from the story of our first federal subsidy, the subsidy to the fur trade? Well, the first lesson is that subsidies produce complacency. People who receive a subsidy are complacent, not competitive. They have no incentive to really innovate. They can just sit back and live off of federal tax dollars. This is what McKinney did. Second, government subsidies do not produce market-oriented businesses because the people receiving the subsidy don't have a competitive to produce a quality product at a low price. McKinney, instead, wanted the Indians to buy plows and hoes and even jute harps. The Indians didn't want that, but McKinney could not be stopped because he had a government subsidy and thus could keep in business. market-oriented products were not produced with a federal subsidy. The third point is that the use of government to receive a subsidy was followed by more use of government to try to hinder the private companies because the private companies were more successful than the government company. In other words, our first government subsidy led to more government interference, or at least the more attempted government interference by Thomas McKinney. Government subsidies did not solve a problem. It led to more problems and almost more federal interference. We can learn a lot, therefore, looking at the first government subsidy. This government subsidy is hardly ever reported in textbooks. Because we don't know about this subsidy, we therefore can't learn from it. I suggest we can learn a lot from it. For more information on John Jacob Astor and also on the first government subsidy in U.S. history, I recommend John Hager's book, H-A-E-G-E-R. It's called John Jacob Astor, Business and Finance in the Early Republic. The book was published in 1991. It's an excellent book that provides lots of information on Astor, how he was so competitive, and why the government failed to match Astor's business success. And that concludes today's episode of Books with Bert. Thank you all for listening. Be sure to subscribe and rate my podcast on Spotify, iTunes, or any other place where you can get podcasts. We don't want you to miss future episodes. And if you like today's episodes and you want to find more content to fill your heart with love for America and conservative ideas, be sure to check out YAF.org. The conservative movement starts here. Until next time, keep reading.